The only purpose of the Talking Space podcast is to educate and to inform. The views expressed in this program are the opinions, experiences, and conclusions of the guests. They do not represent the official policy or position of the Space Tweak Society as a whole, NASA, any other space agency, company, contractor, or affiliate.
We choose to go to the moon!
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Everybody, to another episode of the Talking Space Podcast. I'm Sawyer Rosenstein, and as always, I'm joined by some of the greatest panelists you could ever ask for. They include Gene McCulka. Welcome, Gene.
Good evening, Sawyer. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thank you. Welcome as well, Mark Ratterman.
I got my Mr. Fix-It hat on. I'm ready to help any way I can.
All right, sounds good. And welcome as well, Gina Hurley.
Hey, Sawyer. I'm just glad to be here tonight.
Indeed, we all are. All right, now let's get started with our first issue, which is the biggest topic. There's a little bit of a problem on the International Space Station. There was a problem with some ammonia loops that they had, which keep the International Space Station and all of their electronics and avionics cool. It kind of shut down. So they had to perform an emergency spacewalk. EVA-1, Spacewalk 1, was performed on August 7th, 2010, and the 8-hour, 3-minute spacewalk, an expedition record, encountered a couple of problems, including an unexpected ammonia leak and a jammed quick disconnect fitting on one of the pumps they were trying to remove. So, any idea of any fixes they may have for EVA-2 scheduled for Wednesday, or are they out of luck?
Well, to clarify a couple things. One, the issue actually revolves around a failed cooling pump that does indeed circulate the ammonia through the system. The purpose of EVA-1 was to go ahead and try to remove that pump and replace it with one of the stores that they have on board the ISS right now. I believe that was brought up by one of the past shuttle missions. I think it might have been STS-128. I know somebody out there is going to correct me on that one. So the objective of EVA-1 was to try to go off and replace that pump. Well, when they started to go ahead and work the lines, the first one, which is, I believe, the first one removed was the M4 line. That one came off with no problem. They got over to M3, and that's where they had the problem. There were about four pump lines connected up to this thing, and each one of these have to be removed in order to go ahead and replace the pump. First, however, you've got to close the valve that feeds all the ammonia into the pump, and then remove the line. And they were able to do that with M4. They got to M3, and the valve just would not close no matter what they tried. At least through conventional means, it kind of stumped them and bit them. I believe after working a few things and with the ground, I believe astronaut Dave Wolf, who was literally Mr. EVA, was also trying to go ahead and lend some wisdom with Doug Wheelock and Tracy Caldwell Dyson, who actually performed the EVA. As to what to try to do to remove this thing, and they worked the problem pretty thoroughly before finally giving up the ghost and deciding that, well, there's obviously a lot of built-up pressure into this thing, so they used a jumper box. I'm not exactly too sure what this thing does, but apparently it helped go ahead and relieve the pressure in there. What they did was they were able to remove the M2 line, which was right next to it, and there isn't a lot of room. There isn't a lot of maneuvering room in that area, so it was. They really had to be excruciatingly careful with this. Imagine, you know, trying to go ahead and work on your car with a heavy pair of winter gloves on, you know, thermal winter gloves on. If you can try doing that, it's, or trying to go ahead and pick up a penny that's sitting on a flat surface with one of those, and you can understand the issue that the two spacewalkers were undergoing. But they were able to go ahead and remove the M2 line, attach it to the jumper box, put the M4 line on there, attach it to the jumper box, and supposedly that was going to go ahead and alleviate the pressure on there. Once those two lines were attached, they removed the M1 line, and then went after the M3, which was the one that was giving them the problems. And it did alleviate some of the pressure. They were able to remove it, but there was a lot of residual ammonia already flying around. And as they were trying to remove this thing, and you could actually see it on the camera, where you saw a few snowflakes of ammonia just sort of, you know, percolating up and just flying all over the place. And you don't want to get that on your suit and bring it into an enclosed environment like the ISS. So there are some, you know, decontamination procedures they had to go through. But they were actually went ahead and did that, and they finally got the line off. But, you know, the time bell rang, so to speak. I think the thing was on, the EVA was only planned for about seven hours, and I believe they went overtime. They went into the 8-hour realm, and because they had to go ahead and do the decontamination procedures, they had to call it a day. So they did not get the pump out, but it's basically configured to do that. They put thermal bags over all the connectors, so this way nothing will, no heat will, you know, the outside heat won't affect it. And they're going to go ahead and pick up from where they left off on Wednesday. I think they did a pretty darn good job, considering this was sort of an improvised procedure. But there's, you know, as we were discussing before we started the recording, you have to look at it this way. It's like, for those of you out there listening who are sort of shade tree mechanics, you guys can go ahead and really, really understand this. There's always that one bolt on the car that you just can't get off, and you wind up, you know, no matter how much WD-40 you have to spray around that one bolt, it just does not want to come off, and you wind up, you know, using having to pull out the pneumatic wrench to go ahead and pull that off, and finally it comes off. But nothing, you know, it's the best laid plans of mice and men always go awry, apparently. But they do have the plan in place to go ahead and pick up from where they left off on Wednesday, and we'll just see how everything goes.
Gene, I got to laugh when you talk about that one bolt that won't come loose, and you put a air wrench on it or something.
Yeah,
That's the point for me, where when that final bolt comes loose, that's when you drop the starter or the transmission, or something drops on your foot or your head. Or
exactly.
And I don't have the details exactly, but I read somewhere where this pump assembly is a pretty massive. A massive unit, 700 and some pounds.
Yeah, it's almost 800 pounds, exactly.
Of course, it's weightless, but you've still got the mass to deal with. And if it's in tight quarters with the coolant lines that they're talking about, and I almost hate when I heard the term quick disconnect yesterday.
Oh, you know that. You know what that means.
Oh, yeah, quick disconnect. I wonder how this is going to work.
Gosh. You know what that means.
You got to wonder if the astronauts that were out on the EVA, and of course ones that are really looking close at this, trying to plan some solutions, if they're not saying them to themselves kind of under their breath, gee, I wish the engineers had planned this a little bit differently. And apparently they can't isolate everything the way it would be nice to, and have to rely on these quick disconnect valves to shut off the flow of the, or not to shut off, but to contain the coolant that's in the lines that are being removed. It's a shame it's not better, but you know, you can only go so far when you're trying to design things. At some point you got to stop and say, okay, this will work. This will do everything we need plus three times more, and we can't go for 10 times redundancy. And tough break.
Yeah. What concerns me a little bit is that they've got the spare on, you know, in storage. They had it with them. they've gone ahead and they pulled the spare out. And basically, you're using the spare tire now, but now you don't have a spare tire, if you get the analogy. So I'm wondering, in the remaining shuttle manifest, is there any room for another pump like this? And if not, what's going to bring it up? Are you going to have a Progress bring it up, or one of the ATVs, or the Japanese HTV, or, you know, is there some room possibly on the projected STS-135 mission that's going to go ahead and bring this up? And
I was just about to ask that exact question.
Yeah, you know, exactly, and that's what kind of sort of bothers me a little bit. So we're going to have to do some digging around, I guess, and ask some questions of some folks that might know about that, and see if there is a manifest issue.
That, or do the old, do you need it or not, and chuck it if you don't.
Yeah, exactly. And, we're down to how many flights now? Two, possibly three, if the Senate and House version of the markup for the NASA budget passes. So is there any room on the STS-135 manifest? I mean, initially I thought STS-135 might turn out to be showbiz, but apparently, meaning that, or just, a flight to just keep the program going one more time and buy some time for some more jobs. And I was hoping that wouldn't be the case. But now it looks like there is indeed a compelling business reason to go ahead and get STS-135 up there, if not just to replace this darn pump, to bring a couple of spares up there. So it's a thought, and you've got to really think this out.
I think I've read where they have two spares on the station, and so they're using one. They'll have one on site for future use. But it's has only been brought up by the shuttle, so it may not be transportable by any other method that's available now. You know, one advantage they've got, we're joking about Shade Tree Mechanic, and they've got a tremendous support team on the ground, doing simulations in the neutral buoyancy, is that what it's called? The pool? Drawing a blank.
Yep, the neutral buoyancy lab.
Yes, sir. Okay. The neutral, yeah.
Yeah. You know, they've got people that are working on that, so they know how tight things are, and I'm sure they'll get it done. Of course, if they have to get somebody up there to break it off, I'm sure there's an astronaut from Hubble that would volunteer to go up there and give it a good push.
I don't think Mike. By any chance you mean Mike Massimino.
Yeah,
I thought
that's about what that. I was just going to say. Yeah.
I thought about NASA's little... breaking off the bar during this whole thing too. I was watching this yesterday.
Sure, more than one way to skin a cat.
Yep.
The next topic that we move on to, we go from the International Space Station down to Earth for a little commercial space news. Our first commercial space topic is that SpaceX, with their Falcon rockets, is now planning to unveil and launch a heavy lift vehicle, just as NASA is currently designing as well. What are your thoughts on this? Is it too much to go for two rockets, or are they copying, or what?
Personally, sir, I think this is in reaction to what both the House and Senate have directed NASA to do, which is develop a heavy lift vehicle. I believe in the Senate, this is trying to go ahead and deflect what both houses have said that NASA should focus on, that the U.S. needs a heavy lift capability, and I can't argue with that. SpaceX basically came out, I guess it was this week, it was reported by Aviation Week on their website. I'm trying to get the exact date here. August 5th, basically saying that NASA should go ahead and concentrate on the development of a nuclear propulsion, and will take care of the heavy lift capability. So, you know, keep COTS going, keep funneling the money, and we'll take care of the whole thing. In fact, they're proposing that, and I'm going to go quote directly from the article here. Their take is that the U.S. government should take the lead on nuclear and commercial industry should go ahead and lead on the building of a heavy lift vehicle. Low-level propulsion technology research and development should be the government lead, with transition to flight development by 2025. SpaceX has proposed, I believe, the Falcon 20, which I believe they're talking about using the article describes as SpaceX's long-discussed Merlin 2 LOX rocket propellant fueled engine, capable of projected 1.7 million pounds of thrust at sea level and a $1.92 million pounds of thrust in the vacuum. And they're saying that it would provide both propulsion for the proposed Falcon 10 and Falcon 20 vehicles. The Falcon 20, they're talking about being almost equivalent to the Saturn V. They're talking about here, you know, I'll read again directly from the article. A growth development dubbed Falcon 10 Heavy would employ 9 engines clustered in 3 cores. Collectively, these would create about 10.8 million pounds of thrust at liftoff and be able to boost 125 kilograms into orbit. The ultimate launch vehicle, the Falcon 20, stands as tall as the Saturn V, and it would go ahead and be able to launch 140 kilos into low Earth orbit. And I actually think this is just in response to Congress saying we're directing NASA to build a heavy lift vehicle, and SpaceX is just basically saying, well, we can fill that need for you. I would like to see SpaceX concentrate on, I mean, they had a wonderful start, don't get me wrong, they really did, but I'd like to see them build on that success first, concentrate on getting Dragon together, concentrate on testing Dragon to make sure it does exactly what they want it to do, which is basically to act as a cargo vehicle initially to the International Space Station, and prove that cargo vehicle first before we go ahead and start talking developing something like a Saturn V rocket. I'd like to see them, you know, really, really concentrate on saying what we're going to deliver right now, instead of projecting what we could deliver into the future. So
I was just about to say that, because for me, that's the thing that's, you know, I know what they're trying to do, but I think that's what just keeps going off in the back of my head, is that if they focus on two things at once, there's going to be a safety lapse. And if they plan to carry people up with Dragon and Falcon, then they should focus on crew safety before they even think about a heavy lift vehicle.
Yeah, I'm forced to agree with you, Sawyer. I think you got to go ahead and first, you know, I mean, it's good to go ahead and project into the future and saying, hey, we could do this stuff, but let's just make sure that we can deliver on what we've promised initially. I mean, it's good to keep your eyes out on future opportunities, but let's make sure Dragon works. Let's make sure that they can deliver on what Dragon supposedly can deliver. That includes crew. Let's make sure that they can do it safely. Let's make sure they can do it consistently. And then, you know, once we've entrusted you, once you've proven to us that you can go ahead and deal with cargo, once you've proven to us that you can go ahead and, yes, deal with crew, then we'll let you proceed further. But not until that point. I know I'm going to get all kinds of letters, and I know I'm going to get all kinds of static from that, but there you have it.
We all are, but I have to agree with you. Alrighty then, so let's continue on with the idea of commercial spaceflight, except this time we're going to a very unlikely source. Boeing is now cutting metal on a possible, on a brand new spacecraft. Any idea who will get the bids for it, or what's the news on Boeing?
Well, the Boeing spacecraft is supposedly designed to ferry 6 individuals up to the International Space Station all at once. But the idea, too, is they're also talking with Bigelow Aerospace and not just NASA. Bigelow is, for those of you who don't know, have an inflatable space station in mind. They went ahead and they've tested an inflatable spacecraft, I believe it was a couple of years back, and it worked wonderfully. So they want to go ahead and try to go and build on that success. And it looks like Boeing is trying to say, so, hey, Bigelow, you want some help getting folks to your station? We can go ahead and help you out with that for a price, of course. And so it looks like Boeing's got their eyes on different clients. And if they could get this act together, who knows? Maybe you will see the rich and famous up there in some inflatable hotel being ferried by Boeing in the not-too-distant future. So one can just keep their eyes out on this one and see what happens. I'm trying to see some more information here. I'm looking at the article. The article I'm looking at, for those of you who are interested, is in the Orange County Register, and it is also was also published on August 5th of last week.
And will also be in the show notes.
Thank you, sir. The Boeing capsule apparently could be launched on a variety of rockets and could make its return to Earth by splashing down the ocean, as crew capsules during the Apollo program did, although it is mainly designed to come down on dry land. I'm quoting directly from the article there. And according to Keith Riley, Boeing's commercial crew and development manager, they're cutting metal right now, and they're making a lot of progress. They're hoping that a demonstration version of the ship will be used in pressure tests in the not-too-distant future. And they're talking about doing an abort test by, I believe if there are no funding, to quote from the article here, if there are no funding hiccups and all goes according to plan, Boeing hopes to develop the ship on a tight time frame with launch pad abort tests and high-altitude abort tests and a crewless flight by 2014.
I don't mean to seem negative, and I definitely hope that Boeing gets this performed successfully, but has there been anybody that has gotten anything off on schedule besides NASA meeting President Kennedy's going to the moon before the end of the decade? Has anybody else kept on schedule?
We'll look at it this way. The shuttle development happened in fits and starts. It was initially set to go, I believe they were looking at 1978, 1979 time frame. In fact, the orbiter's first mission was to go ahead and rescue Skylab, if I'm not mistaken. As we well know, the orbiter did not go ahead and keep that appointment, and Skylab re-entered the atmosphere, and Columbia was eventually launched on April 12, 1981. So if that answers your question, there you go. I mean, the space station itself was initially proposed by Ronald Reagan in 1984, and he wanted it completed within a decade. The first element of what became the International Space Station was launched in 1998. So, again, surprise.
I hate to say this, but current NASA, 2003, even when you think about it, the shuttle program will retire by 2010. It's already going into 2011.
Yeah, but, again,
nothing sticks to schedule, but I hope they complete it and prove us wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. I mean, this is business, and business likes to keep the schedule, so who knows. But I know development glitches happen. in spaceflight, and you want to make sure, especially in spaceflight, that you have all your I's dotted and T's crossed, because if you don't, you're in an environment that could bite you and bite you badly. It's a very unforgiving environment, as we've found out three times. So, I'd stick to schedule is one thing, but, you know, go fever is another. And let's just hope that, you know, as you pointed out, Sawyer, let's just hope that both, you know, Bigelow, Boeing, and SpaceX do not get a case of go fever.
Oh, Spirit, are you there? Scientists believe, as of right now, that Spirit may be gone. They've been performing a special test to try and ping the robot, essentially, and see if they can get a response from it. They expect a response if it's in hibernation mode within a few months. However, they are not positive that Spirit will reawaken. As you'll remember, in May, Spirit kind of got stuck on a rock and has been there ever since, and was unfortunately in an unfavorable position for its solar panels as Martian winter approached. Do you think that Spirit will reawaken? Let's take a poll. What do you guys think?
Gosh, I hope so. I mean, the odds are against it, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Do I think it's going to reawaken? I'm going to say a hesitant no, but this robot has proven us wrong so many times, and it would be neat to go ahead and have her come back to life again.
I don't think so. I think they're done. They've already outlived. I mean, how many lives do these cats have? I think they've already outlived themselves. Well into the future, beyond expectation. I think this is final.
Well, I'm going to go for yes. And no particular basis for that other than hope and the fact that it's early on in their process of reestablishing contact. So, you know, I'm optimistic that in the future here that power levels will come up. Maybe, you know, batteries will come back up far enough to power up systems. So I say yes.
And I am actually going to have to go ahead and agree with you, Mark, there. I'm going to say yes. Mainly because they've gone through so much already is actually my main point there. They've withered so much, and even though it was in an unfavorable position, they still said that it was possible that it could get enough energy. And honestly, even if it does come back, it will be weak, that I will admit. I believe if it comes back, it'll be weak, but I'm saying, yeah, it probably will come back.
Of course, you know, there's a new kid on the block that's starting to come online.
Yeah,
Mars
she just
Curiosity.
Took her first steps.
Yeah, Mars Curiosity's out there. So, you know, it may give Spirit the comfort to know that, okay, I've done my job and we got somebody else coming to keep Oppie company, so...
Very true, and I love the way you worded that. Move on to our next story, in which Gina took a little bit of an adventure and she encountered some interesting Apollo artifacts. Do you care to share your story with us, Gina?
Certainly. This week, we found ourselves, my family and I, at the Virginia Air and Space Center in Hampton, Virginia, in a very sort of interesting area of the world. South of Washington, D.C., or southeast, is the Hampton Roads area, where a bunch of cities and towns converge. Norfolk, the huge naval station there, and the Langley Air Force Base. And this Hampton Roads, or this Chesapeake Bay area, is where NASA Langley Research Center is. And their visitor center is the Virginia Air and Space Center in Hampton, Virginia. And, you know, we walked in. I had called ahead of time just to get some brief information on the center. And they said, oh, you know, 2 or 3 hours, you'll see everything. Well, I guess I walked in there with very low expectations, which were pleasantly met and exceeded. Sadly, the place was fairly empty, and we had the place pretty much to ourselves. So we got to do whatever we wanted without waiting. And because they had several cool simulators in there and other interactive exhibits, and we spent plenty of time in all of them. But some of the highlights were certainly, it is the home to the Apollo 12 capsule. And if you know anything about the Apollo 12 crew, they are an all Navy crew. And so I guess that would make sense that Apollo 12's command ship would be located near the largest American naval station in Norfolk. And looking at it, the heat shield on the bottom seemed really burned out. I've seen 4 of these capsules now, but this one by far blew me away. The way it was presented and on exhibit, you couldn't touch it. However, it wasn't all covered up in plexiglass. A lot of the other ones I've seen exhibited or on exhibit, like Apollo 17's at Johnson Space Center, they really present it so you're looking inside the capsule. Here, the capsule was not opened. They had mock-ups of the astronauts inside, but the door was shut or the hatch was shut, and it really allowed you to see just how badly burnt up and scorched this thing was. And the astronauts had signed the capsule, the Yankee Clipper, that had visited the Ocean of Storms, the date, and their 3 names, Conrad, Gordon, and Bean, of course. But there's several other great exhibits here. They had a planetary model on display that was hanging from the ceiling, this huge gallery. And Saturn, Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune were just huge. I mean, like the size of my living room. Earth was about the size of a soccer ball. And wow. Mercury was basically a baseball. They had planetary surface samples, which was kind of cool, I guess. I mean, you know, the gas giants were basically an empty jar, but you really kind of got a good perspective of, you know, the surface, how they had it displayed. They had this Mars transporter, which it was kind of a little hokey, but you walk in and they give you sort of this 5-minute movie simulator where you're on your way to Mars, and then the door opens when the movie's done and you walk onto the planet Mars, where they had a huge life size mock-up of Spirit or Opportunity. They really didn't specify, but one of the rovers, and really gave you, I mean, it was bigger than I thought, so that was kind of interesting to see. They had a moon rock there. They had a Mars rock, which apparently is a piece of a meteorite that scientists have confirmed from its composition that it was a piece of Mars that broke off from an asteroid encounter and found its way to the Earth's surface in Africa. And they had a lunar landing simulator where you stand in the limb and land the limb, which was cool. They had a huge global projection sphere that was interesting because you could project onto the planet what you wanted to see, weather or, you know, other sort of Earth processes happening. And they just had some really cool mock-ups of rockets, and, you know, they had basically a model rocket for everything NASA has launched in perspective of each other's sizes. And they also had a space shuttle simulator where you could sit and try to land the shuttle. In addition to an entire DC-9 that they had suspended from the ceiling, you walk in there, you can sit in the cockpit. They've got some flight simulators that you can play with in there, and just some other great aircraft. They had an F-18 on display, a couple of other smaller NASA test aircraft. But, you know, it was well more than I thought was going to be in there. And there's a lot more interactive other exhibits that either ATC exhibits where you could learn how to speak ATC, and just, you know, how flight works, how aviation works. Really, I was pleasantly surprised, and, you know, we all just really had a good time. But I'd say it's well worth a half a day to anybody that's in the Chesapeake area or the Hampton Roads area. It's actually north of Norfolk. You have to cross the bridge to get there. And it's actually in Hampton, Virginia. But I would definitely check it out. It's VASC.org, the Virginia Air and Space Center, if you find yourself in the area.
Hey, Gina, question for you. How did that stand? How would you go ahead and rate that facility over, say, the Johnson Space Flight Center exhibits? Because I know you had a little less than favorable opinion of those guys, or at least the visitor center.
I mean, sadly, they had some Orion stuff, and you know, when you walk in that quote unquote Mars simulator, you know, you're kind of looking at the Ares V or what it was supposed to be. It's supposed to be the spaceship that you've taken to get to Mars, which, you know, just seems a little sad to me. I guess, you know, obviously updating these exhibits, you know, obviously there's an expense to it. But it's, you know, it's not the Johnson Space Center. I don't know if I can make a fair comparison there. I mean, you don't get to see Mission Control. You know, you don't get to have this sort of feeling and sense of this is where it all goes down. It's not trying to be that way. The visitor center at Johnson Space Center is small. And I would say that the exhibits, they're probably a little bit better than the Johnson Space Center. But the Johnson Space Center has obviously more to offer in terms of, you know, seeing NASA. So you can't quite compare it exactly. Also, they did have a big IMAX theater where they were showing the Hubble 3D and some other first-run movies there, too. So, you know, you really could spend a day of it if you want to get an IMAX movie in, too.
Okay, cool.
I got a question, Gina. How was it received by other families that you saw going through there? You know, you've got two small boys, and they enjoyed seeing the things that you described. How about other folks that were through there? Is it a popular thing?
You know, there really wasn't any other families. I saw a couple of groups of teenagers who seemed fairly engaged by the stuff in the solar system area. There was a family with older children in the DC-9 with us at the time, and they were waiting for the flight simulator. And, you know, we sort of walked out, and I didn't really encounter them again. I mean, it was really empty, which is unfortunate on a, you know, a Friday afternoon in the summer. They've got sort of extended hours in the summertime. I just would have expected more people in there. So, again, we were lucky that we had the place to ourselves. However, sad, I suppose, that not more people were taking advantage. So, I mean, it was reasonable to get in. I only spent $11. I think the kids were, I don't know, 7 or something like that. So, you know, it's not going to break the bank, but there were no, you know, camp groups or anything like that when we were there, so I can't really give you a fair. I just didn't observe that many other people.
Okay.
Hey, Mark, you had a pretty good adventure yourself last week.
Oh, yeah. It was the beginning of a 9 days on the road for my wife and I. And, of course, we're talking about the tweet up at NASA headquarters with TJ Creamer. And I'll roll on into that if you're ready.
Rock and roll, please.
Well, as I said, it was at headquarters. And remind me at the end of a few things that I want to mention. I've got a surprise for you. Ooh. But, you know, the basics of it was just the excitement of being at NASA headquarters. I'd never been in D.C. at that place before. I'd seen some of the historical and, you know, typical tourist spots in D.C. one other time that I was there, but this was the first time at NASA headquarters. Didn't even know where it was. The directions they gave me were great. I found it right away and, you know, had a few hours to kill. But once the doors opened and we were in the auditorium, you know, it to me, it felt like the same kind of, I'm going to describe it as magic that that I felt at the other tweet-ups. You know, it's just the excitement of being in a different place and knowing that you've got some very different people that are going to be talking to you. And one of the things that impressed me the most, and I really have to say this 100% about the astronauts, is how well they speak, how well they present themselves, their professionalism, and at the same time, they're cordial and friendly and approachable. And TJ Creamer was right there with all the best. He was just a great spokesman for describing what it was like to be on the ISS. One of the things that was interesting to me, not having focused much on the Soyuz launches, was a bit of that process. And he talked about the launch being a relatively quick affair, from the rollout of the rocket to the crew being on board and launching, that it was a pretty quick procedure, and that it was quite a relief to hit zero G at main engine cutoff. He talked about some of their jobs on board the ISS, and something that I never thought about, and I'm not a photographer, but I've played with the camera, and certainly not anything close to what they use, enough to know that a camera, you have to know what you're doing to get the photograph that you're trying to get. And he said a real important operation is photography of an arriving shuttle, of the thermal protection system tiles. And I never thought about it, but he says, you know, you have to be at your position, you have to be ready for it, you have to take pictures at just the right rate to get the best images of different sections that you're targeting. And, you know, really it just brings to mind how widely trained all of these astronauts have to be. I mean, they're literally, I think, a jack of all trades. We were talking about the repair aspects of the coolant pump, you know, and along with that, they've got to deal with electronics. They got to deal with computer systems. And here TJ Creamer was on station for over 5 months. And it was interesting. He also talked, and this was, again, something that I hadn't heard much about, but he talked about the process of being, you know, back on Mother Earth. And he said that at from his return, plus 58 days, that there are many, many hours of workouts to get muscles that are really not worked on orbit back into shape. And he said thanks to his people that were overseeing his rehab and his reconditioning, that he was able to play tennis again. And I thought, man, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Not just to be able to, you know, walk and function and get along and not have it really be an extreme burden to you like it must be at the start, but to be able to get out there and run a tennis court to play a game of tennis. He did make one statement that I kind of got a kick out of. He said, gravity is a weak force, but after long periods of time on the ISS, it's hard to convince crew members that have their education in the realm of physics. It's kind of hard to convince crew members that gravity is a weak force, because when you're back on solid ground, it sure is a big one. He talked about the science that's done on the ISS, and he said it's a great example of the teamwork between the crew and the scientists on the ground. And you think about the mission control in Russia, you've got JAXA, NASA, ESA, you know, they all have aspects and involvement of what's done on board, and it takes a lot of coordination. So I think the crew that's on station is a lot busier than we would expect. They really, I think, probably have some pretty full days. And he said that the camaraderie and the cooperation with the amongst the crew was really a asset. It was something that enabled them to, you know, if they had tasks that they were doing, that they did the work that was on their schedule. And if they, you know, one of their objective was they wanted to get ahead. They wanted to keep up with the flow. And if they could get ahead, And he said basically getting ahead meant two things. You could help one of your co-workers with tasks that they had, whether U.S. or Russian. He said there was no differentiation there. He said if you could help one of the cosmonauts on board, he said you could do that. He said then you all had more time to look out the window. And he described the cupola as a wonderful, wonderful place. And, you know, I think that's something that we've heard from many an astronaut. I'm kind of backing up here, but when he started the tweet up, he said, "Greetings to everybody and thanks for the way we expand the Twitterverse." I think that was kind of interesting, the connection that he has with Twitter as being the first astronaut to use a live internet connection on board the ISS. And he did say, and again, this is my unfamiliarity with Soyuz, and I'm kind of jumping around, but he said that from undocking to landing is a four-hour event. He said it can be done faster in an emergency. And let's hope they have the time to do things step by step and not get in a hurry. Because, Gina, what you were talking about, the heat shield on the Apollo capsules, I'd sure hate to hurry a Soyuz operation and miss a step or miss a switch throw or something that you would need that they'd give you that safe, smooth reentry and landing. Last thing, this is again something that's hard to appreciate. He said a very important skill is communication in Russian. Even though the official language of the ISS is English, and I threw this in just like it is in aviation, you can fly anywhere around the world, and if you're a pilot, you're gonna speak to air traffic controllers worldwide in English. You know, fluency will vary from place to place and pilot to pilot, as I observe, you know, here in the U.S. Sometimes you hear pilots that are fluent but difficult to understand. But, you know, here again we're talking about Russian, and somebody in the audience asked him a question or they said something and he answered them in Russian. And I thought that was pretty sharp. It indicates, again, that the variety and the depth of things that these men and women have to acquire skill at to be at the point where they can go fly and do a good job. There was one thing that really touched me. He said, thinking about looking out the window, looking out the cupola at Earth, he said, the message of how small we are screams humility when you look out the window. And I thought that was a great way of saying something that we've heard from many an astronaut that's had that perspective of being in space and looking at Earth. And humility just seemed to sum it up in a really good way. My wife, who was my guest, and I thought that was an interesting way that NASA had this set up, where I applied to attend the tweet up, and I listed her as a guest, and we were both there was room for both of us, which I'm thankful for. But she made the statement about I put down Astro TJ in a tweet, but TJ Creamer, she said he was wonderful, funny, and inspiring, and made you want to reach for the stars. And certainly something I think that was echoed, because when they reached the end of the time that they had allotted for TJ to talk to us and then for us to ask questions, which he responded to, we reached the end of those two time blocks and they said, well, this is the end of our session. If anybody would like to come down and talk to TJ, get your picture taken with him, autograph, anything you'd like, you know, now's the time to do it. And somebody said, well, I've got one last question. And we proceeded to go for at least another 15 minutes, where there was question after question after question. And TJ Creamer, he's a credit to NASA. He's a credit to the U.S. Army and, you know, a professional in all ways. And I just think he was fantastic. You want to hear my surprise for the event?
By all means, please.
You bet we do.
Gene, I already talked to you about this one. The surprise is, of course, for me, first time at NASA headquarters for an event like this. But second is just what's outside the door. Unknown to us, except for having gotten there like 3 hours early, NASA headquarters has a library. And we went in the library and started talking to a couple librarians that were there, and found out just what a phenomenal resource that is. But the NASA headquarters library specializes in collection, preservation, and dissemination of space policy and management information. And the librarian told us, he said, you think of NASA, and he said, you think of the engineering, you think of the nuts and bolts and rockets and hardware. And he said, but, you know, we're sort of different here. We're headquarters, and this is what we specialize in, space policy, the history, management information. And he said, we frequently have people come through here from the political side of the world there in Washington, also astronauts, media folks that come in that are doing research. And it's not a big, big library, but apparently they've got some resources that are utilized, requested, and utilized by quite a variety of people. And in the back, and he told us this, which I kind of got a chuckle out of, he says, here we are, headquarters. We don't have a visitor center. But in the back corner of the library, he said, there's a room back there where we've got some books that you can buy some of them, he said, and there's some things that are free. And, of course, there was actually there's posters and stickers and little pamphlets and bigger pamphlets and pieces of literature that covered NASA's history for unmanned type exploration and a variety of things. And so anybody gets a chance to go to NASA headquarters, give yourself some extra time. Check out the library. Plus, they got all kinds of, in some cases, models. And in some cases, for instance, we've talked about STS-134 coming up with the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. Well, they had a piece of the AMS-1, which I don't remember the history of that device, but apparently was a component that has flown in space before. And they had a piece of it sitting on the counter in a case. And lots of other interesting things. They had the little diorama, little space peeps. That's not the right term.
Sure it is. The little marshmallow peeps, sure.
Yeah, well, marshmallow peeps. It was mission control with peeps. And, you know, something that somebody put together and entered in a contest and stayed at the library. So they got quite a variety of little interesting memorabilia that you can look at and walk up to, and it's not all behind a closed display case. It's things that you can peer at and look close at. So great time all around.
And the library sounds like someplace I'd walk in and not walk out for another 6 months.
Oh yeah, you'd want to save some time there.
Yeah, I mean that sounds like a place I'd probably lose myself in. One other quick question for you, Mark. You did have an opportunity to stop over by the Intrepid. I don't know if you got a chance to go ahead and take a look at the 27 seconds exhibit for Apollo 1, and I'm just very interested in what your thoughts were on that, because I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to get in there and see that.
Yes, we did. We saw that a couple days later. It was, it's hard to find the words. It was very touching. It was very sobering to look at the displays that they had, the pictures, the text description of things, and to look. And also there was a section of it that was the world's response to that tragedy. And it was quite touching to realize how serious a moment that was, how difficult a time it must have been to get past and to go forward on. And from what I've read and heard from astronauts of the Apollo program, that it was something that they took very personally too. It was a great display. It was extremely well done. I could have spent quite a long time there. It seemed like on a lot of our trip, we felt like we were on a lightning sweep through wherever we happened to be. And, it's bigger than I expected. You walk into a little portion of it, and you turn the corner, and then there's more, and then there's more, and then there's more. And I just thought it was really, really well done. Well, I got to throw out one more little tidbit. This was in one of the tweets that I made from the TJ Creamer tweet up at headquarters. He said, be the best team player, not necessarily the best player on the team.
Big thought to take away.
And in a lot of respects, that really sums up the astronauts of NASA. You know, they work so well at being team players. And NASA as an organization is a phenomenal team, I think. And, you know, I sure hope that they can come back in 5 years from now and just blow us away with the accomplishments that they have at that point. 10 years from now, the same thing.
It really sounded like you had an amazing trip, and it's a lot of different things, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, welcome home.
Thanks.
Welcome home to you both. Oh, and Mark, one more little tidbit. There was a little thing you were mentioning with Mary, your wife. There was a little moment between her and T.J. Kramer, a little bit of a pin exchange, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I've got to mention that. I have to, because it was such a neat story.
Sure. My wife, Mary, and she's Mary_Andromeda on Twitter. She, from some of our travels to various tourist things, in particular Disney in Florida, started acquiring these little pins and lanyards that you can stick on pins. Of course, now we've got quite a few from NASA and the space program. Well, here we are at the Tweet Up, and we're going up to talk to TJ, and she has a Star Trek pin. And, you know, one of the things that he commented on was about science fiction. He said, you know, what do you think the one thing out of the science fiction world is that you know, we would like to have today? And, you know, people, I'm sure, thought a variety of things, but he said, on the ISS, he said, we've got communications, but he said, we would love to have something like the little communicator badges that the Star Trek crew always had, where they could just touch their lapel and instantly communicate from anywhere to anywhere on the ship or on a planet from orbit and things like that. And so anyway, when we went up to talk to him, she had a Star Trek pin, and she gave it to him. And, you know, he was happy to have it. And I think it would brought kind of a chuckle to him. Of course, it didn't work as a communicator, but, it's all of a sudden my brain stalls. Sawyer, help me out with that one. Make it sound like I knew what I was going to say.
All right, we'll do. Was I the only one that encountered an audio cutout?
No, yeah. that was me where my brain stalled and I quit talking.
No, you get what I was doing there? I was trying to make it seem as if it wasn't your fault, Mark.
Ah, here we go. Skype.
I know, that Skype. Darn Skype, right?
Doggone Skype. But so Mary gave Astro TJ a Star Trek pin, got a nice chuckle out of it, and no doubt he probably won't remember me because I was the one who asked a technical question about the ISS, and she's the one who gave him a pin. So it's funny how you make friends.
Speaking of making friends, we ran into an old friend of ours too, correct?
Ooh! Dr. Tom Jones, you
yes, sir.
Betcha.
Oh, yeah.
And his co-author, Robert Dorr, Bob Dorr, ran into both of them at the Smithsonian Udvar-Hazy Center Air and Space Museum the next day, and got to talk to Dr. Tom Jones for a few minutes, and was telling him that we had recently talked to Walter Cunningham and that I had a better appreciation of the hazards of near-Earth objects than when we had talked with Dr. Jones on our show before. And that was fun. That was nice getting to shake his hand and talk to him for a minute.
Yeah, both Walt and Rusty kind of went ahead and gave us a really good appreciation on all those all those things.
Yeah, that's right. That was Rusty Schweiker.
That was Rusty Schweiker.
That wasn't Walt Cunningham.
Yeah,
I said it right to I said it right to Tom Jones. I just said it wrong then. Which is why Gina's son is better at the astro trivia than I am.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess sometimes.
Yeah, he's darn good.
He can whoop me anytime on that stuff. I guaranteed.
Although I think I can probably go head-to-head with him a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you can be my pitcher.
Competition.
Oh, you do.
We'll have to invite him on and see how that works.
Oh, yeah. That'd be kind of cool.
So, yeah, Mark, definitely thank you for sharing your trip with us.
My pleasure.
And Sawyer, I think you've got something to mention real quick, too. There was a little event that occurred over at the Challenger Center where you work.
Yes, indeed. Just recently, we were actually proud and honored to host the oldest participant in a simulated space mission at any Challenger Center. Two women, one of them by the name of Gussie Levine, the other Lillian Modell, were both born in July of 1910, making them 100 years old, the oldest people ever to participate in any simulated mission at the Challenger Center, beating the previous record of 94 years old.
Just goes to show, as I believe Keith Cowling, who posted this that little tidbit of news on NASA Watch when it first was released by the Challenger Center on their website there, said you're never too old to learn, and I wonder what their thoughts were as far as going through the training and going through the simulation. It seemed to be kind of neat.
Unfortunately, I wasn't working that mission because I was away. Sure. I would have loved to have asked them that.
Yeah, that would have been neat to hear their impressions, because obviously,
how dare I go away on vacation to Cleveland?
Well, they obviously saw Apollo 11, and here they were basically following sort of their footsteps in a simulated way.
I only saw it; they were in their 60s.
Yeah, exactly. So it must have been kind of neat to do that.
Yeah, so hats off to everybody at the Town of Ramapo Challenger Center, formerly the Lower Hudson Valley Challenger Center. And with that, I believe this episode has come to a close. So I would like to thank everybody out there for listening, and also our panelists. Gene McCulka, thank you.
This has been a fun night, Sawyer. Thank you so much for emceeing.
Not a problem. Thank you as well, Mark Ratterman.
Thanks, everybody. Had a good time, and we got some good stuff out of us.
Oh, yeah, you don't have to wring us dry now. And thank you as well, Gina Herlihy.
Oh, thanks for listening to my journey to Virginia.
Not a problem. We're glad you made it home safely, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Amen to that.
And as always, again, thank you for listening, and have a great day, night, evening, or whatever it may be where you are.